Hello, and welcome to this PERspectives Continuing Education Podcast, created by healthcare professionals for healthcare professionals. PER is a leader in healthcare education and offers free accredited medical education programs in a variety of accessible formats at gotoper.com.
Hello, and thank you for joining us today for this program about addressing healthcare inequalities entitled Tailoring Management Plans to Address Healthcare Disparities in Cystic Fibrosis. This program is brought to you by Physicians Education Resource and is supported by an educational grant from Vertex Pharmaceuticals. My name is Dr. Emily DeMango. I am director of the Adult Cystic Fibrosis Program at Columbia University in New York City. It is my pleasure today to be joined by two of my colleagues, Dr. Clement Wren and Ms. Winsome Sewell. I will point out that I think each of us has been working in the field of CF throughout our entire careers. I would like to start by asking Dr. Wren and then Ms. Sewell to please introduce yourselves to our audience.
Hello, I'm Dr. Clement Wren. I'm the CF Center Director at the Children's Hospital of Philadelphia and a professor of pediatrics at the University of Pennsylvania Perelman School of Medicine.
My name is Winsome Sewell, and I'm the pediatric social worker at Morgan Stanley Children's Hospital of New York, Pediatric Pulmonary Division and Cystic Fibrosis Center. I've been working there for 30 years with the pediatric populations with cystic fibrosis.
Thank you, Dr. Wren and Ms. Sewell. We're so thrilled to have everyone together today for this very important program. We'll start off today's discussion first with talking about the impact of healthcare inequalities in persons with cystic fibrosis. And I'd like to start out just by making a few points that I think are pertinent to our discussion. It is clear from the literature that demographic factors, including socioeconomic, ethnic, and racial minority status, have a profound influence on health outcomes and survival in cystic fibrosis. Racial and ethnic minorities make up a growing proportion of people with CF, consistent with the changing demographics in the United States, and currently account for about 18% of all people with CF. We know that studies really over the past 2 to 3 decades have demonstrated worse outcomes and poor survival in persons with CF of low socioeconomic status, as indicated by factors such as insurance, educational status, and family income. So in thinking about racial disparities in CF, I just want to make a few points that have been borne out in medical literature. Minoritized patients with CF have worse pulmonary outcomes and acquire Pseudomonas at an earlier age. And we know that acquisition of Pseudomonas is associated with more accelerated progression of lung disease. Hispanic people with CF are known to have a high rate of mortality compared to non-Hispanic whites and die at an earlier age. Black people with CF have more severe pulmonary imaging findings and more respiratory symptoms at the time of diagnosis compared to other groups. Finally, Hispanic people with CF have lower lung function. Interestingly, lung function is lower in Hispanic people with CF, but the rate of decline in lung function is the same as it is in the non-Hispanic population with CF, suggesting that factors early in life really affect some of the disparities in these outcomes. And I just want to say that it's important to consider that racial and ethnic disparities in CF-related health are probably attributable to unequal social conditions and deeply rooted structural inequalities. For example, both Black and Hispanic people with CF are more likely to reside in neighborhoods with lower median household income and have higher rates of state insurance coverage than their non-Hispanic white counterparts. Minority people with CF are often missed on genetic panels, which can lead to delays in diagnosis. And finally, introduction of highly effective modulator therapies is expected to only widen existing health inequities in CF, since minoritized people with CF are less likely to have CFTR mutations targeted by these modulators. So I will stop there in terms of giving background, and I would love to turn to Dr. Wren about your thoughts on how the impact of newborn screening might affect health inequalities in CF.
Yes, thank you very much, Dr. DiMango. Yes, well, I think similar to what you just reviewed, CF newborn screening as it's practiced in the United States today and in many parts of the world, continue to perpetuate or have disparities and inequities. One of the things we know is that most newborn screening programs now are moving towards a DNA-based algorithm, but the CFTR variants that are selected for analysis, we know will more often miss infants who are Black and Hispanic. Furthermore, we also recently showed that the age at first event is also longer in Black and Hispanic infants. Now, in that study, that was an observational study, so we don't really know why, but some of our speculations are that people of color have less access to healthcare. It's also possible that more of these infants are one variant positives and that physicians feel less urgency in referring those infants for sweat testing. And there's probably some unconscious or conscious bias in perceiving CF as a disease that only affects white people, therefore also reducing the urgency to evaluate an infant with a positive newborn screen.
Thank you. Ms. Sewell, can you tell us a little bit about what the barriers are to healthcare as a driver in health inequities in CF?
Well, from my experience in terms of what I've seen over the last 30 years, I would have to say that the barriers are, as you stated earlier, there's economic barriers, there are education barriers, and health coverage. And also, I think one of the largest barriers that we really don't talk about is trust of healthcare in general. So what happens is a lot of patients usually stay away from the hospital unless they need urgent care. And so it takes a long time to develop trust in our patients for them to even come in for appointments. Also, another barrier is, you know, we live in a tri-state area. So we're in New York. So we have patients who are coming from Connecticut, New Jersey, and the local New York City area. And a lot of patients, their families are one income. And if they don't go to work, they don't get paid. So sometimes our families have to decide, you know, what's more important, my paycheck or the appointment. And a lot of times, unfortunately, they choose to go to work. And so their child is affected that way and not being able to come in for care at that particular time.
Yeah, right. I had not thought about that. You know, what you said about establishing trust with the healthcare system is so interesting, and I think really hits home. Do you have any thoughts on what providers can do to establish more trust with our patients?
Well, I've been thinking about that, and I think we need to really always try to address the elephant in the room. And I think that if we actually ask the patients, what are their thoughts, get them more involved in the conversation, have the conversation not be a one-way conversation, and get their input, you know, we would be able to build trust, and they feel that they're valued, what their thoughts are important, and they feel that they're a part of the healthcare team. I think we need to have them feel that they're a part of the healthcare team and not that we're always telling them what to do and they don't have any input.
Right, right. Okay, thank you. Before we go to our next module, Dr. Rand, do you have any comments that you'd like to add?
I just agree with everything Ms. Sewell said. I think especially if you kind of look at the newborn period and the infant population, right? The infants we try to see every month And then every other month in the second 6 months of life. So that means in the first year, there's a lot of appointments. And many of our families, right, they have to make a choice between being able to come and being able to get a paycheck or do other things. And so it is very difficult. The other key point about that, going back to something you were mentioning, Dr. Mango, is that we know that nutritional status early in life is a strong predictor of lung function in later life. So again, if we don't achieve good nutritional outcomes in the first 1 to 3 years of life, children, by the time they're 6 to 12 years of age, have significantly lower lung function. So this whole process and these disparities then get generated very early in life. I think the other compounding thing to that is that not all many minoritized people or families who have children with CF have less access to technology. So we don't have as much ability to do remote care as we might for other families.
Yeah, that's a very important point. And, you know, that also brings up talking about costs associated with CF, like giving up a day of income, food and security issues that have come up, particularly exacerbated by the COVID-19 pandemic. A recent publication stated that nearly a third of families with CF have some form of food insecurity, and it's not necessarily those who are in lower socioeconomic groups. So not only might the family have to decide between missing a day of work, but might have to decide on whether to use limited funds to purchase food or, you know, take the large expense of driving into the city to come to a doctor's appointment or taking public transportation. So I think that's another important point. Okay, I think now let us turn to talk about the strategies and tools that we can use for evaluating patients for a CF diagnosis and how those tools might impact patients from different racial and ethnic backgrounds. Dr. Ren, would you be able to start out by talking about tools and strategies to prevent delayed diagnosis in CF? I know you talked a little bit about it already.
Well, so one of the things that I'm working with the CF Foundation is developing some guidelines for best practices in newborn screening. So in particular, there's two aspects. One, so, you know, newborn screening starts by using a biomarker called immunoreactive trypsinogen, or IRT. And with how you set the cutoff for an abnormal IRT can really affect how many infants you'll detect. And we have data on what are the best ways to establish the IRT threshold. And then, as I mentioned, the choice of variant panels. Ideally, as the cost of sequencing comes down, we'll be doing next generation sequencing on all these dried blood spots, and we'll be able to detect more of these rare variants, which are especially more common in Hispanic infants. So those are two aspects of how we can improve newborn screening to improve earlier diagnosis and reduce disparities.
Right. Yeah. And I will add to that, as an adult provider in evaluating patients with possible CF diagnosis as adults, and only 5 to 10% of new diagnoses each year in adults. But in that evaluation, along the same lines, I think it's important to know your population and do appropriate genetic testing. Oftentimes, the recommended genetic panel for screening for CF may not be related to your specific geographic population, and you might want to consider more extensive testing, like full genotyping, for example, that would pick up some of the less common mutations that we know minoritized people with CF may have, and that may not be picked up on the regular genetic test panel that we do for CF. So I think that that's also relevant for adult diagnosis. So thank you. Ms. Sewell, you talked about barriers to access to care. Can you talk a little bit about some measures that might improve access to healthcare in individuals, particularly minority individuals with CF?
Well, I think one of the things that's really important is really education. I've always thought about having a health van, you know, pinpointed in certain communities, and really educating families on the role of healthcare, the value of going in for your yearly checkups is really important. Another tool would definitely be, you know, educating the providers in terms of how they communicate with the patients. I think that having cultural competence be part of our educational training that we do yearly is important, so that we can really understand how our patients and families perceive us and how we need to be able to communicate in a way that they understand. And I was thinking about, you know, some of our families have literacy issues. And so we really need to focus on how can we help them understand what we're saying. Do we need to use visual aids? You know, are there other things that are out there that we can access to really help our patients and families so that they feel comfortable when they do come into a clinic or into a hospital, that they feel valued?
Thank you. Are there any barriers in particular that you think exist for early diagnosis in minority people with CF?
Well, I think Dr. Ren stated that earlier, which is, I think a lot of physicians or pediatricians within the community see CF as a Caucasian or disease. And so, you know, when a parent is telling them, you know, my child is not gaining weight, they will, you know, have every other differential diagnosis except for CF.
Okay. And Dr. Ren, do you know what the numbers are? What percent of babies diagnosed with CF are diagnosed by newborn screening?
Currently in the registry I don't know, babies, I think almost all of them are diagnosed through newborn screening. But you know, in terms of new diagnoses, 65% are diagnosed through newborn screening. So there is still a large percentage that are diagnosed, outside the neonatal period. Another analysis we did, though, is we looked at, if you look at like the missed diagnoses in the registry, the percentages of Black and Hispanic infants or who are misdiagnoses are higher than, and it's disproportionate. So again, suggests that, so it's not just theoretical, these panels, but the differences in newborn screening algorithms, but we think that there really is evidence that there's more late diagnoses.
Okay, so just so I understand, when you say missed diagnoses, do you mean missed by newborn screening?
Correct. Yes, because that is a question in the registry. Yes, that's correct.
Okay, that's very interesting. And just one other question that I'd like to ask you, Dr. Ren, for people in the audience who may not be as familiar with early signs and symptoms of CF. I know this is a very big question, but in general, what symptoms should prompt pediatricians to consider CF in their differential diagnosis? Assuming it's not picked up in newborn screening, how can pediatricians be prepared to think about the diagnosis?
Well, I mean, the classic symptoms, the classic signs are failure to thrive and recurrent respiratory infections. I think the latter may be actually even more important in those late diagnoses because, again, pancreatic sufficient infants tend to have these rarer variants. But, you know, if back in the pre-newborn screening days, I think we saw just about every clinical manifestation, you know, including bleeding diathesis from vitamin K deficiency, rectal prolapse. So it's a real challenge, I think, especially today, because, you know, in the United States, we've been doing newborn screening since 2010. So, and many states, for example, in New York, started in 2002. So many primary care physicians out there have actually never seen a clinically diagnosed a child with CF. So they don't think to necessarily do diagnostic testing, namely the sweat test. And I think, again, that's exacerbated by unconscious bias towards what people think is the epidemiology of CF.
Yeah, and I wonder if, you know, general pediatricians assume that if it wasn't picked up by newborn screening, that's not the diagnosis. So perhaps there needs to be more education about that.
Yes, very much so.
Yeah. Okay, well, thank you. I'd now like to turn our discussion to current treatment options for people with CF. And I'd like to start off this session by briefly giving a history of a patient that I care for and then perhaps generating some discussion among our group. This is a 30-year-old Hispanic woman who has a G542X, which is a nonsense mutation, and a deletion, a CFTR deletion mutation, which is more common in minoritized individuals with CF. This young woman was diagnosed with CF at the age of 6. She's pancreatic insufficient, has had, unfortunately, progressive decline in lung function, presently with an FEV1, which is the main marker we use for disease severity in CF, an FEV1 of 28% of predicted. She requires oxygen use at night and with exercise, but not during the day. Her treatment includes standard treatments for CF, short-acting bronchodilators, alpha-dornase and hypertonic saline as mucolytics, and airway clearance with a vest device. Sometimes she does these treatments twice a day, sometimes three times a day during exacerbations. She typically requires treatment with intravenous antibiotics about three times a year. A few years ago, she did have a very high risk pregnancy with an FEV1 about 35%. She did carry a pregnancy to term. It was a complicated peripartum course, but both baby and mom did very well postpartum. Her weight is low. She sometimes takes appetite stimulants to try and gain weight. And screening for diabetes, which we do once a year with glucose tolerance tests, has always been normal. This patient has been evaluated for lung transplant and is currently deemed to be too healthy to be actively listed, but of course, she's being very closely followed. Before I turn to my colleagues for discussion, just some of the points I want to highlight again, we've talked about this, but I think it's important enough to say again, is that due to racial and ethnic differences in CF mutation frequencies, there are large disparities in access to modulators. We're all familiar with modulators as being life-changing medications for most people with CF. In fact, over 90% of non-Hispanic white people in the United States have mutations that qualify for a modulator, but only 70% of American Black people with CF have a modulator responsive mutation. And as is relevant to this patient, only about 75% of Hispanic people with CF, again, compared to over 90% of non-Hispanic whites, are eligible for modulators. So this patient, unfortunately, with her mutation, is not eligible for modulators. For that reason, continues to have significant symptoms of CF. And I think this case also highlights some other disparities that have been discussed in the literature regarding lung transplant referral, not necessarily for CF specifically, but for really all diseases that require lung transplant. There's data showing that there may be a later referral to transplant and higher risk of dying on the lung transplant list for minoritized individuals. So I wanted to just use this case to also talk about that. Ms. Sewell talked about financial barriers to getting to the medical center for physician or provider visits. And I think the same is true about clinical trial participation. It's very hard for people to take time off from work if they're losing income or have to care for family members in order to participate in clinical trials. And I know we'll get to this a little bit later in our session. But there's also, unfortunately, minority patients are underrepresented in clinical research in CF. And I think that is yet another contributor to some of the disparities that we see. So I'd now like to turn to my colleagues And first, just ask you your thoughts about this patient. If you have any input, are you familiar with these kinds of cases?
Oh, yes, I think definitely. I feel I've definitely had several Black and Hispanic patients, and it's always disheartening to look at their genotype and realize that we can't use medications like elexacaftor, tezacaftor, ivacaftor, or other highly effective CFTR modulators. And that's why I think it's so important that we develop, for example, treatments for nonsense mutations, which at the NACFC last month, I thought there was some really exciting information about that. But then, as you say, we also need to make a very concerted effort to recruit people from minoritized populations to participate in these trials, because we need the diversity of representation in the study population.
Yes, in preparation for this session today, I reviewed some of the literature on minority enrollment into clinical trials for the recently approved elexacaftor, tezacaftor, ivacaftor, also called Trikafta. And it was disheartening to see that even though almost 10% of the CF population in the U.S. are Hispanic, only 4 to 5% of individuals in the Trikafta trials were Hispanic. Similarly, while 5% of Americans with CF are Black, 0 to 1% of people enrolled in the Trikafta trials were Black. So I think we all really have a lot of work to do to come up with strategies for really increasing participation of all individuals in clinical research for CF, because these studies, in addition to being important to study novel therapies in people of all races and ethnicities, also sometimes potentially offer medications to patients earlier on before they're approved. For those who are not necessarily practicing in the field of CF, Dr. Ren, would you mind just giving a brief overview of some of the standard therapies for cystic fibrosis?
Oh, sure. Well, of course, airway clearance is a key treatment component. You mentioned your patient is on the vest, which the fancy term for that is an extrathoracic high frequency oscillating device. So airway clearance is very important. We have two major inhaled medications that can help enhance mucociliary clearance. One is hypertonic saline, which is thought to help restore the airway surface liquid layer, and recombinant human Dornase alpha, which cleaves DNA, and up to 10% of the dry weight of CF sputum is made up of DNA. So inhaled Dornase alpha reduces sputum viscosity from that. For patients with chronic Pseudomonas infection, we have inhaled antibiotics such as tobramycin and S-trianam that can be given on an alternate month basis. And then finally, azithromycin in low doses, depending on your weight, either 250 or 500 milligrams three times a week, has been shown to improve lung function and reduce exacerbations. And the mechanism is thought to be that it reduces inflammation. Other anti-inflammatory therapies, such as systemic corticosteroids, have been used, but their effect is pretty marginal. And because they're associated with so much side effects, they're not usually standard therapies anymore. Similarly, high dose ibuprofen is anti-inflammatory, but again, has side effects that tend to deter a lot of clinicians from using that medication. So those are some of the core non-modulator therapies that are available.
Yes, thank you. So all the therapies you mentioned really treat the symptoms of CF, the thick viscous mucus, the chronic growth of bacteria in the lungs. And before modulator therapies really came onto the scene, that is really all we had for CF. But I just want to talk a little bit about how modulator therapies work. Rather than really treating the symptoms of CF, we really think of them as treating the underlying cause of CF. It's not gene therapy. It's not a cure for CF. But these compounds serve as correctors to modify the folding of the mutated CFTR protein and potentiators, in that they activate the chloride channel that's on the apical cell surface of epithelial cells. So the modulators really present a different form of therapy other than simply symptomatic therapy that we've had up until really recent years. Ms. Sewell, in talking about modulators, even though this patient is not eligible for modulators, can you talk a little bit about any barriers that you see in the use of modulators among racial and ethnic minorities?
Well, I think that we in our clinic, we have to spend a lot of time just educating our families on what the modulators are and how they work and how they could be beneficial. At the same time, again, there is a lack of trust in the community. And I think we saw that with COVID-19, that a lot of people were eligible and able to be vaccinated, but was really highly suspect of the healthcare system introducing this vaccination. And, you know, especially in the African American community, there's been a mistrust of any type of treatments or experimental treatments because of years of inequity and things that happened in the 60s. And so I really think that we have to continue to educate our patients and really work with them, work with the community, the pediatricians who they trust probably even more so if they've been seeing the child since birth until they're about adolescent or into early adulthood, that they feel that they can trust their pediatrician more than they can trust our team, to say.
Yeah. I was interested to learn that when Ivacaftor, the first modulator, was approved, the uptake in minoritized individuals was less. And not only that, providers were more likely to prescribe the drug to people with private insurance and people who had participated in the clinical trials. And we know that minoritized individuals are less likely to be in either of those groups.
I mean, the other thought that I had also was the fact that if we're educating our patients about these modulators and talking to them about it constantly, I think that they would know that there's a place for them and how beneficial it would be, and they wouldn't be so fearful. And so I think moving forward, that one of the things that we would need to do is definitely spend time educating our families, spending time educating the pediatricians in the community, some of our patients, see nurse practitioners. So I think it's really educating everyone with whom they come in contact with for them to be able to develop trust. And also when we think about the therapies that our patients use, we're talking about the vest or the nebulizer. Sometimes what happens is that they're unable to pay their light bill. Their Con Edison bill, gets shut off. And so a lot of times their treatments are missed because of lack of income to be able to just do their regular treatments as well.
Yeah. Thank you, Ms. Sewell, for these very enlightening ideas that I think many of us have not really thought through in caring for our patients. So I thank you for that. Let's now discuss strategies to address healthcare inequities that impact care for patients with CF. And we will begin with the patient case.
Hi, my name is Tina Mobley, and I was diagnosed with cystic fibrosis at the young age of 10 years old. I was actually misdiagnosed at first when I when the doctors concluded that I had the illness. And my symptoms were very salty skin. So when I would play sports, I was very active as a child. I would have, my shirt would literally be drenched in sweat. I was also, another one of my symptoms also was me having problems gaining weight. So that was another factor. I also had very shortness of breath. And again, just being an athlete, playing outside and just growing up, that has also been a very challenging for me. But I will say that sports did help me mold me into the person I am today and help my lungs and help me manage the illness. Another one of my symptoms that I also had was I had, in addition to the salty skin, was I was also hospitalized a lot. So it came to a point where the hospital became my home. So, you know, that was also very challenging, you know, being in and out of school and, you know, just dealing with, you know, those complications. And very uniquely, I was actually mixed diagnosed and had the doctors thought I had asthma, but then concluded that I had cystic fibrosis, which caused me going in and out of the hospital and from doctor to doctor. So at the time, I actually didn't have an understanding of the disease. I'm like, cystic fibrosis, I couldn't even pronounce it. I was only 10 years old. But what I do remember is being in a hospital and, you know, at the age of 10, and my parents, when the doctors told my parents that I had the illness, you know, they were like crying. They were like, oh my gosh, I didn't even know, like, why didn't they tell us, you know? And with me being adopted, when my parents picked me up from like the foster care center, they told them that I had asthma. So that was the disparity there. And also the fact that I was African-American, they did say it wasn't as common in African-Americans, which is why they also thought I didn't have the illness. And again, it is an invisible illness and it does affect people differently. So it was very tragic, and it's sad that it came to the point that, you know, I almost had to pass away. But I do remembering the doctor saying, you know, me not really having an understanding of what this illness was at the time, you know, that my capabilities was fairly limited, that, you know, again, playing sports, like that was my main thing. I always loved playing sports, and I'm like, I have to run track, I have to play basketball. And, you know, the doctors always said like, oh, take it easy. I also learned at the time about the life expectancy of things. And I believe it was like 30 years old, where they're like, oh, you know, typically people with this illness, they don't live a long time. So that was very heartbreaking to me. But at the same time, I was very optimistic growing up as a kid. And I was also very hard-headed. So like someone telling me that I can't play sports or my capabilities are fairly limited, I was like, no way, you know, I'm not taking no for an answer. Like, I'm going to overcome this illness. I'm going to beat the odds, and I'm going to push past my fullest potential. I will say that, like, as I, starting out younger, I was on a ton of medication. I'm trying to think, like, 9 different medications. I would say, like, it was at first, it was when I first learned that I had the illness, and then also, again, being part of school and different extracurricular activities, it was very hard trying to adapt to that new lifestyle. It was early mornings. I had to take my albuterol machine and also my vest machine twice a day, morning and night. And then, you know, growing up, going into college and then being a D1 athlete, that kind of played a huge part in it too, because, you know, we had 5:30, 6 a.m. workouts. And then on top of that, I had to deal with taking my vest machine, my albuterol machine earlier. So it was a lifestyle that even now, like, I'm thinking, like, how did I do that? But my daily routine at the time when I was younger, and it's still similar, but I take less medication now that I manage the illness a little bit. Albuterol machine, vest machine. So thinking of like the Afflo vest that helps clears the mucus throughout your lungs. I also used to have to take Creon, which is pills that help breaks down like the foods that I'm consuming. So That also helped with like my bowel movements. I also, I had a lot of allergies, so like Nasonex. So it's like a spray that's in your nose, and then also Claritin that also helps with like any like other nasal or environmental allergies. But yeah, a ton of different pills, my machine, vest machine, which is like known to the CF community, and my Buterol machine, which I had two different solutions that I had to take. And that was twice a day. So morning, early mornings and late nights, I would say. And then growing up in college, same routine. And I came, you know, eventually, like when you start going through the motions, it's like, it feels like it's part of your day to day and you kind of get used to it. It's like habitual. So moving to now my daily routine, the doctors, because I've been doing so well. And I think part of that is because me being an athlete, it helped me, like now I don't have to take like the pills I still do take my vest machine and my Pulmazine and my Buterol machine every morning, but I don't have to take as much like pills as needed for cystic fibrosis because I managed the illness so well. And if I continue to do so, it will stay like this. Well, I was adopted when I was younger, so I don't know my real parents. And so again, when they found out I had cystic fibrosis, it was through sweat tests, and they couldn't really do genetic testing on my parents. And I was told by my doctors that I had a very rare mutation of cystic fibrosis. So, you know, again, there's different levels to cystic fibrosis. Like not everyone qualifies for a modulator. And because I was doing so well and keeping up to date with my treatments, and I guess I can't, my body type or whatever it may be, they said that I didn't, you know, qualify for modulators. I didn't really dive into the why. It was just more so because I had a rare mutation. Well, surprisingly, like Reese, I haven't been hospitalized as often as I was when I was younger. I wouldn't even say like I haven't been hospitalized really as much for cystic fibrosis. When I was younger, it was much, much different. It was to the point where the hospital literally was my home. But as far as my checkups, it went from being every other month when I was younger to now being 3 to 6 months. So that's like a huge drastic change. And literally just thinking back, like it was just to the point where I felt like, and again, you can be optimistic and, you know, try to be as positive as you can, but then there's this other part of you where you're like, you know, is this something, like when you're a kid, you're like, oh my gosh, like, is this something I have to deal with for the rest of my life? Like you kind of have like that depressing moment and you're like, is this something that has to continue? But again, due to technology and, you know, the doctors and research, like now it's like managing the illness. It's not as a burden as it was when, you know, a few years ago. And that's thanks to technology. So my checkups are now from 3 to 6 months. So when I was younger, I had my local cystic fibrosis doctor. He retired and now he referred me to a new doctor in New York City, and I go to her. I recently just moved to South Jersey and I decided to still keep my cystic fibrosis doctor in New York City because I didn't want another new doctor because, you know, it's just the bear of explaining, you know, this is what happened to me, you know, saying the same story over and over again. So New York Presbyterian, I heard they were the best. So I, you know, started going there and I think that's where I'm going to stay. And so like my commute there is about, depending on traffic, an hour. But again, being that it's like 3 to 6 months, it's not too much of a burden. And then also some of my visits are done virtually and in person. So it's like that, having that balance. Barriers having access to CF care. When, you know, younger days, it was, again, not as common. I didn't really, you know, one couldn't even pronounce the illness at the time. So it was like, was I didn't really know how to pronounce it. So finding that doctor, we didn't know who to go to. There wasn't a lot of resources readily available for the illness. And I also think that a lot of people with the illness, they were treated the same rather than a doctor looking at each person as their own unique individual. I feel like we all were like kind of taking the same medications, doing the same routines. But as far as like access to care, it wasn't as resourceful as it was back in the day as to compare now. Like now I can just go on Google and kind of find a CF local care doctor as opposed to back in the day. As far as like for example, my vest machine, it was super hard trying to, and even now I feel like it was at the time hard to get certain machines and that, because the cost was just so expensive. So that was a challenge.
Tina is a 27-year-old African-American woman who was diagnosed with cystic fibrosis at the age of 10. She was adopted and diagnosed as asthmatic when she was a younger child living in foster care. During her time with her new family, it was noted that she sweated a lot when playing sports and had difficulty breathing. At one point, she was taken to the emergency department and nearly died. That is when a thorough workup was started and sweat testing confirmed that she had cystic fibrosis. Until the age of 10, no one even considered CF as a potential diagnosis for Tina. She did not have prenatal genetic testing, and even now she is uncertain of her CF genetic mutations because she believes she cannot find out because she is adopted. All she knows is that she has a rare mutation that has not qualified her for any clinical trials with CFTR modulators. At this time, Tina lives over 1 hour away from her primary care CF center and travels quarterly for checkups. Dr. Wren, after listening to Tina's story, what stands out in this case as a potential, really for Dr. Wren and Ms. Sewell, what stands out in this case as potential healthcare disparities experienced by Tina? We can start with you, Dr. Wren.
Oh, well, several. I think you can just start from infancy and how she was adopted and put into foster care. The data that, again, that Black and Hispanic children are more likely to be placed into foster care than with relatives. And foster care usually results in less continuity of care, and especially continuity of medical records. And that probably contributed to the delay in diagnosis. I think we've already talked about the fact that there's probably unconscious bias that an African-American girl with clinically diagnosed asthma could not have CF, and that probably related to the delayed diagnosis. And of course, you know, the longer you have untreated CF, the greater the degree of chronic lung disease and other complications from CF become. And then finally, we've again talked about how she has a genotype that is not eligible for currently available modulators, and the distance that she lives away from her CF center also is a barrier for her to receive access to care.
Yes, thank you. You know, interestingly, with the COVID-19 pandemic, where we all, patients and providers, have become more comfortable with telehealth, I really think it's offered some respite to some patients who really face financial barriers getting to the CF centers. I think we now have a better mechanism to at least doing some telehealth visit, if that's what the patient chooses to do, and increase access to care in a sense that we had talked about earlier. Ms. Sewell, is there anything else that stands out in this case that you wanted to talk about in terms of healthcare disparities experienced by this young woman?
Well, when I, read over the case, one of the things that I thought about was the fact that a lot of children, once they are removed from their family, the history of whether there was some type of, whether the family had asthma or there was cancer. Like, there's a lot of things that we don't know about the child's history. And so those who are involved in removing the child from the home and placing them, whether it's in a foster home or an adoptive home, do not know all the story, especially the fact that she got adopted at the age of 10. I think if she had gotten adopted early on, As a newborn, I think we may know a little bit more about her, but all of that pertinent family history is lost from the time of birth to the time she's 10, especially if she's been moved around from different foster homes and then to an adoptive home. And so that puts her sort of at a disadvantage in terms of really getting the care that she needs or access the care. And I do agree with Dr. Wren, the fact that she was diagnosed with asthma, you know, that's possibly, that's the only thing that they could think of, because as we stated earlier, that patients with CF, when they are diagnosed, a lot of even the pediatricians are surprised because they're considering that CF is a Caucasian disease.
Thank you. I'd like to talk a little bit about the multidisciplinary approach to CF management that we're all familiar with. Ms. Sewell, can you talk about members that make up a CF care team?
Yes. So I think that one of the things that I enjoy about taking care of patients with CF is the fact that I have the opportunity to work with a multidisciplinary team. And that team comprises of the physician, the nurse, myself, the social worker, the dietitian, as well as the physical therapist. We have sometimes a pharmacist, we have a psychologist that's available. And so, and even infectious disease physician, which I think is really important in terms of making up that team so that we're all on the same page as we're talking to the family, that we're getting feedback from a lot of different team members when we have our clinical medical rounds. And sometimes we'll be surprised that there are certain things that a patient might mention to one provider and not mention to the other. And so with that being said, I think it really brings a large amount of information to our, and makes our clinical rounds really rich in that everyone has input, and we get different ideas of what we can do and help our patients, you know, to be able to be, especially when it comes to compliance as well.
Thank you. As we wind down our hour, we talked a lot about health disparities, and I just would like to get each of your views on what do you think we can do? It's clearly a systemic problem. What do you think we can do, three of us, in our day-to-day work to address potential disparities in care? Dr. Wren, can I begin with you?
Yeah, well, I can name you at least two very clear things. I think one is that we as caregivers need to be aware of our potential unconscious biases and actively work to overcome them. I'll just give one example. You know, we had one African-American boy who was repeatedly admitted to the hospital. And one of the things is that people looked at his refill rates, right? So his refill rates and his no-show rate were really low. The no-show rate was really high. That's because he's in the hospital all the time. But and I don't know that necessarily that people would have jumped to that same conclusion if that child was white. So just thinking about, you know, comprehensively examining the barriers and understanding. And that mom also had two jobs. It was very hard for her to get to appointments and things. I think in newborn screening, I think there's a role that all of us can play in advocacy, because newborn screening, you know, so newborn screening is a state-run program, and Phil Farrell and I just had a paper accepted for publication in Pediatric Pulmonology, so we don't have 50 newborn screening programs, because there's some states that do screening for other states. We have like about 46. Every one of them is different, but I think each of us who are involved, especially in CF care, should understand what our newborn screen algorithm is and advocate for best practices with the Department of Health and our state legislatures, especially if that algorithm is exacerbating disparities.
Thank you. Thank you. And Ms. Sewell?
I also agree with what Dr. Wren said. And I was also thinking about the fact that when we talked about multidisciplinary team before, I forgot to mention the genetic counselor, because I think that that's really, really important. And a lot of times we've had to, you know, have our patients meet with the genetic counselor so that they can be more educated on the mutations that they do have. And so the other strategies, and I agree with advocacy, and I know I myself as a you know, care provider have been to Albany to really talk to our legislatures about making sure that our patients have access to care as well. And so that they're not left behind, especially with health coverage, to make sure that we have health coverage for our patients. And also that even though they have health coverage, is the pharmacy benefit in terms of the medications, you know, being covered is also one of the ways that we can advocate. Some patients, you know, there's a amount of enzymes that some patients can get based on their insurance. And so we do spend a lot of time really going back and speaking to the medical director at a lot of the insurance programs to increase the amount of enzymes that our patients can get so that they're being compliant with the treatment regimen that we lay out for them.
Thank you. And as for me, I think I echo with both what both of my colleagues say. You know, Dr. Wren, you brought up implicit bias. And I know on our team, we talk about that a lot during our weekly meetings. And we really reflect on that and sort of try and point out if we think ourselves or one of our team members, you know, thoughts about a patient might somehow involve some implicit bias. And we are actually trying, you know, we're a fairly large center in an urban area, and we have a lot of minority patients. We're actually in the midst of a survey now, trying to understand from all of our patients what their perception of their healthcare is. Do they feel they're respected when they come to our office? Do they feel that we talk too quickly and they can't understand what we're saying or use jargon that they don't understand? Do they feel that they are included in decision-making? Is there shared decision-making? And we obviously are collecting that data from all of our patients, and we want to see if there are differences based on socioeconomic background, educational background, racial ethnic backgrounds. So I think, you know, we're all starting to really challenge ourselves and our teams with thinking about this and figuring out ways, because we certainly realize we all need to do better. And it's so important for the health outcomes of our patients. So this has been a really excellent discussion, very impactful, about addressing healthcare inequalities and tailoring management plans to address disparities in people with CF. I would like to thank my colleagues, Dr. Clement Wren and Ms. Winsome Sewell, for participating with me in this educational activity. We hope that the information we shared with you will be helpful as you continue to bring excellent care to all of your patients. And I want to thank you.
Thanks for listening to this PER Perspectives podcast. If you would like to receive CE credit for participating in this program, visit our podcast page on our website at gotoper.com. Find the name of this program and click on the link for the post-test. If you liked today's episode, please consider subscribing to our podcast on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Google Podcasts, Amazon Music, and many of your other favorite podcast platforms. While you're there, please take a moment to rate us. Thanks again for listening.